On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Ted Cruz wrapping the bacon around the semi-automatic weapon to cook it.
I understand that trade is not a sexy issue.
Nobody knows where the Republican Party is going to land. I mean, it's kind of like a country road. No one knows where it will end.
In many ways, Marco Rubio is the Michael Jordan of American politics.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
I sincerely thought that like 5-10 albums would be what I had in me. At one time when I was a kid, I thought there was a point where I could see getting 5 albums done. That, you know, I thought, yeah, I can do that. And who knows, maybe I'll even get 10 albums, you know.
Right.
It's just, I can't believe that I've made this many now. That I'm on my way to 30 albums, you know.
David Bowie talking to Nick Harcourt on KCRW back in 2004. David Bowie died on Sunday, 2 days after releasing his 25th studio album, Black Star, on his birthday. He had just turned 69. He was born David Robert Jones in Brixton, London, in 1947. He became both an outsider performance artist and a mainstream pop star, a voice for the outsider and the ultimate in cool. We're joined by two KCRW DJs to talk about his life and work. Chris DeRitas is KCRW's former music director. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
And Eric J. Lawrence is the station's music librarian. Hi, Eric.
Hello.
So, Eric, you were up till 3 a.m. last night because, of course, you also have a show on KCRW, and I understand you dedicated the entire show to David Bowie. Is there a particular song for you that encapsulates who he was?
The answer is no, because it's impossible. This is an artist who had a discography that is so rich and lengthy that to sort of narrow it down would be impossible. However, the song DJ from his album Lodger, I am a DJ, I am what I play. This is something that I take as somewhat of a personal mantra. Song like Ashes to Ashes, which was one of his big hit singles, that was sort of maybe one of my first approaches to his music. I had the incredible honor to remix one of his songs, was offered the opportunity to remix one of his songs, Golden Years, as did Chris. So it's impossible to sort of see exactly which direction I want to say is the one song. His discography is as rich as anyone's in terms of having a personal connection to me as a music fan.
Chris, what about you? What is your personal connection to David Bowie? Where in his vast discography do you first land?
Well, I worked with David on Shrek 2. Mm-hmm. He actually did a reworking of Changes for Shrek 2. That was in the early 2000s. But back in 1997, he came by KCRW. I did a session with him around the Earthling album. And, up until that point, I was simply a fan and following all his sort of chameleon-like shape shifts over the years, you know? But sitting down with him, one of the first things that you're captivated by are his eyes.
Yeah.
I kept looking at him and I kept thinking, wait a second. So I'm sorry, I'm just a little distracted. So tell me, what happened with your eyes?
What it is that I was whacked in the eye by a terribly strong young man. When I was about 12 years old, because I nicked his girlfriend.
You were 12 years old?
We were both 12 years old. Rather precocious, the two of us, I think. But we did have nice jackets.
He hauled off and hit you?
Yes, he did, and put me in hospital, as it happens, and I had several operations on it. But what did happen is that it left me with a blown-up pupil. An enlarged pupil. So it does give the impression of being a different colour.
It does.
But in fact, it isn't.
Mm.
Well, some people say it is.
Yeah.
But I don't think we'll ever know. Do you?
So he had a sense of humour, obviously.
Oh, yeah. And so eloquent. I mean, just listening to him speak was just really, really enchanting.
Eric, take us back. Who was David Bowie before he was David Bowie? He made up that name.
He
the
did.
The Bowie part, at least.
That's right. Yeah. No, he was, you know, somebody that was interested in theatrical things as a youth. And obviously music. You know, he was the Beatles and the Stones. He had an early group, I think the King Bees or something like that, that recorded a single in 1964. It was Davy Jones and I think it was the King Bees. And clearly, when you hear the music, it is obviously modeled after a Stones or a Beatles sort of flavor. But I think in part because of his theatrical background, he was really interested to kind of reinvent himself and really present something above and beyond just simply your traditional music making. And obviously, too, that background led him to get involved into filmmaking and mm-hmm. acting. And it appeared in a number of prominent films throughout his career as well.
And he got to start, as we said earlier, in Brixton, was born in Brixton. And did he go to art school? How did he develop his sense, his musical sense?
I believe it was an art school background. But, you know, it's also sort of he was this coming of age in the 50s and the early 60s was really sort of a remarkable time. There's a certain sort of media savviness. I remember seeing a clip of him being interviewed on some British news program. He was representing the Association of Long-Haired Youth, and he was the president of this organization.
Well, here we are. Long-haired men, you've got to have your hair, 9 inches long before you can join?
Well, I think we're past that over now.
Have you?
Yes.
Now, exactly who's being cruel to you?
Well, I think we're all fairly tolerant, but for the last 2 years, we've had comments like, darling, and can I carry a handbag thrown at us? I think it's just had to stop now.
And so, you know, he was interested in characters and creating a persona. And I think that, you know, is something that an artist that's going to have longevity kind of has to do. When you're singing the same song over and over again, you have to embody that character in order to make it convincing. And he was interested to do that with every song, with every album. He was creating these new characters.
Of course, the most famous is Ziggy Stardust.
Ziggy Stardust, of course. But, you know, each incarnation, you had the Thin White Duke later. You had sort of the 80s version with the bleach blonde hair. But Ziggy Stardust was also showing this point of becoming an icon. It was not only merely the music that he was making at the time, which was revolutionary in itself, but also the image.
Yeah. Well, Chris, talk a little bit about how he made that music and what he told you in that interview.
You know, he was heavily influenced by the writings of William S. Burroughs and Allen Ginsberg and Kerouac. And in the conversation with him in 97, he's just turned 50 years old. I was asking him to explain a writing process that was introduced to him by William S. Burroughs. It was a process that he would use to jumpstart his creative process.
It was literally done with scissors and sellotape. I mean, I cut up anything in sight. Something I'd written, something I'd found, something which was an old favorite piece of writing of mine. And I cut them into 3- and 4-word pieces and then shuffle them almost in the hat and pull out at random pieces and re-stitch them together. Mm. Sometimes there were complete sentences or complete ideas that came out of that way of working, which I could never have thought of in a million years. I mean, they're sort of these wonderfully planned accidents. And sometimes it was incoherent and illogical, but there was the spawn of an idea was in there. It was something that one could bounce off and use. It would give you an idea and a new avenue, a new way that you hadn't approached something.
And, of course, he worked with a lot of famous musicians, such as Brian Eno, Iggy Pop.
Philip Glass. I mean, the collaborations over the years.
He co-produced Lou Reed's Transformer album in 1972, right. Sort of on the heels of his success as Ziggy Stardust. And that was, of course, the album that had Walk on the Wild Side. And when you listen to the record, knowing that Bowie was involved with it, You can hear his background vocals. I think Mick Ronson, the guitarist that is closely associated with David Bowie during this era, he did a lot of the string arrangements for that record. So he was very interested to collaborate with somebody like Lou Reed, who was a hero of his. The Velvet Underground was an important influence for him. Talk about Iggy Pop. The Stooges were also sort of an innovative band in the late 60s that he was engaged with. But then he was also very interested to kind of help other artists that he had been working with. He had heard through the grapevine that the band Mott the Hoople were on the verge of breaking up, and he was a big fan of the band, and so he offered them the song All the Young Dudes. He wrote the song for them. That became Mott the Hoople's sort of signature song for their career and revived their career as well.
He collaborated with John Lennon.
He, absolutely, yes. And you know, later in his career, Mick Jagger, and Dancing in the Streets. I mean, one of the most 80s of moments of all time is that music video. You know, working with Nine Inch Nails later in his career as well. And somebody that had a spirit of innovation and creativity and wanting to sort of bounce that off of as many people as he could.
So he was an innovator, but he also changed with the times.
Yeah, I mean, one of the great things that I always think about when I think of David Bowie is his ability to wrap himself in, you know, new styles and musical directions that he finds compelling or challenging in some way. I mean, when he came in 97, he had just done an album called Earthling, which was drawing on the drum and bass sort of thing that was happening at the time. He dabbled in it on Outside, but he went full frontal on Earthling, and he took it into a rock setting, which hadn't been done yet. I mean, Everything But the Girl had done sort of a pop thing, but then Bowie just took it and, you know, layered it with just screeching guitars and Hendrix type licks.
And he, as we said, released his final album on Friday, on his birthday, and it's getting a lot of airplay here on KCRW.
You know what? It was number one last week before we even knew that he was in the throes of passing away. It was the number one. It's the number one album this week.
Yeah, it was the number one record in the UK sales-wise. It was number two in America, only defeated by the monolith that is Adele. And it's been sort of fascinating because there's been so much sort of attention to Bowie over the past couple of weeks with the impending release of this album that it really has felt like a celebration of coming out on his birthday. There were a lot of cover stories already built into the various magazines that were being released this month in celebration of the record. So it was sort of a culmination. It almost seems too perfect for it all to have kind of come together at this exact moment. Yeah. But at the same time, it certainly makes it no less shocking to have learned this weekend of his passing.
And this album is sort of a jazz album, or he worked with a jazz quintet?
There's a saxophone that kind of follows his voice through large parts of the album. One of the tracks, maybe we can hear a bit of that as we go out with this, but it's called Lazarus, and it's getting extreme heavy airplay at KCRW since we got it.
All right, well, I want to thank you both very much for coming in and sharing your vast knowledge and remembrances of David Bowie.
Thank you.
You can hear Eric J. Lawrence on KCRW Sunday nights from midnight to 3. His show Last Night, the entire show devoted to David Bowie, you can hear streaming at kcrw.org. Chris DeRitas has a show on Saturdays from 6 to 8, and he'll be playing his entire conversation with David Bowie on that show this coming Saturday. And let's listen to one last clip of David Bowie speaking to Chris about getting older.
It's hard to feel what that feels like until you get there. It's one of those trying to explain the taste of an orange to somebody. You know, it's almost impossible. It's an indefinable quality. And it really is one of those things that comes with getting older. And it's all those stereotypical answers that you always get from older people. And they're all absolutely true. Mm. It's really irritating. Everything you've heard is true. Yeah, you don't know anything. And I mean, it's often put in a hostile fashion. And it shouldn't be, because it disencourages people from the idea that to age is something that one can do with a certain dignity and excitement and enthusiasm for life. And that's the one thing that I think is very rewarding about getting this far.
Look up here, I'm in heaven. I've got scars that can't be seen. I've got drama can't be stolen. Everybody knows me now.
And we'd love to hear from you about David Bowie, so give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or comment on our Twitter or Facebook, KCRW Press Play, and share your feelings about David Bowie. Coming up, the Supreme Court arguments this morning in a California case that could cripple labor unions, and Sean Penn interviews El Chapo. The weirdness that broke over the weekend, broken down next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. On Saturday, Rolling Stone published an interview with the Mexican drug lord known as El Chapo. The interviewer, not a seasoned journalist, but Sean Penn, the actor. El Chapo was captured last week after breaking out of prison. The interview was conducted back in October while he was still on the run. Apparently, El Chapo wants a movie made about his life. The whole situation is so surreal. It sounds like a movie already, but not everyone is amused. Raul Reyes is an attorney and journalist and an opinion writer for CNN. His latest piece is called Sean Penn's Naive and Dangerous El Chapo Interview. Welcome to the program.
Hey there. How are you?
Thank great. You. Great. Thanks for being here. Why naive and dangerous?
Well, I think it was dangerous because, for one thing, he put himself and his, the Mexican actress who accompanied with him to do these interviews, Kate Del Castillo, at enormous personal risk, not just, you know, making the trip to see El Chapo and setting up, you know, the secret arrangements to see him and interview him. But you have to remember, when you're talking about these cartels, one of the hallmark of these Mexican cartels, which function not just in Mexico, but in at least 50 countries around the world, is that when they feel that they have been slighted or disrespected, let alone double-crossed, they take action. And that very often includes taking action against not only the people they're directly associated with, but with their loved ones. And we now know from this interview that Sean Penn did, there have been at reports, I read one today in People magazine, saying that this interview, along with some other connections he made with celebrities, led the Mexican authorities to the capture of El Chapo. Now, just that fact alone, if El Chapo and his syndicates, which, by the way, continues to thrive and function even when he's under arrest, decides that Sean Penn may have played a role in his capture, I mean, that could have potentially lethal consequences. I think Sean Penn was very reckless in journeying there, and also the actress as well, Kate Del Castillo, who went with him.
Mm. But journalists take these risks all the time, all over the world, and some
right.
of them end up being murdered for those risks. You know, would it be any different if a journalist had done the same thing?
I think one way it would be different is, for example, with Sean Penn, you know, for example, if someone, say, from the U.S. government, they have some cause that where they could launch an investigation into the circumstances of this meeting. But generally for the U.S. government, before someone like Sean Penn, who's primarily known as a celebrity, would be able to invoke his First Amendment right against testifying or providing more details about his activities, the test is whether they make their primary living as a journalist. And in Sean Penn's case, although he's written for other publications, including The Nation and, you know, very well-respected publications, he's not primarily a journalist. I think a big difference here, it's not against the law to interview a fugitive. It's not against the law to go, for example, there are many people who would love to interview North Korean, the leader of North Korea, or people in Iran. None of that is illegal, but it is extraordinarily risky. I think another big difference between Sean Penn and a professional journalist doing this, obviously, would be in the results, because the article that they ended up with, it's tremendous. It's probably one of the most popular in Rolling Stone history. It's generated a tremendous amount of attention, but mm-hmm. we didn't learn that much from it. You know, some people, it's very subjective whether or not you like Sean Penn's florid writing style. But for example, in many ways, he expressed a type of admiration for El Chapo, you know, writing about his warm smile and that he seemed like a father, that he had indisputable charisma. And you have to remember, in Mexico, over the last 7 years, there's something like 165,000 homicides, at least 20,000 last year, the majority of which are linked to these drug cartels. So he's not approaching this interview with the type of seriousness that it deserves, because for the thousands of Mexican families and DEA agents and U.S. government agents who have risked or lost their lives trying to capture El Chapo, it's very disrespectful, I believe.
Yeah, right. Sort of making him look like a kind of a folk hero almost,
right,
in some of the prose. And yet, I understand that some Mexican journalists in places like Sinaloa do self-censor and take
yes.
pains not to anger the cartels for their own safety.
Right. They do it out of fear for their lives. And to give you an idea, it's not just something that happens. It does happen, indeed, in Mexico, in wide parts of Mexico, in the Northeast, in Sinaloa, in various regions that are controlled by the cartel. It also happens in the United States. For example, the major newspapers in the border cities. Now I'm talking the U.S. side. Mm-hmm. In McAllen, Brownsville, Laredo, these are all, you know, main cities in Texas. Their editors of the papers that do not allow reporters there to cover anything related or possibly related to the drug cartels, let alone go to Mexico, because it is too dangerous, because there is a very real fear of retaliation, not just against the journalists, but against their families. And also, Mexico itself, it's a very dangerous place to be a journalist. I mean, I think there are dozens of Mexican journalists who have been reported murdered over the last few years, I think between 60 and 90 over the last decade. And those are just the ones where they were confirmed murders. There are many more who have simply disappeared. So the Mexican media in large parts of the country is really hamstrung because they don't dare report on these events or developments, because they know there will be personal retribution for themselves and their loved ones. And unfortunately, stories like this, you know, Rolling Stone is very prestigious. It's an internationally known paper. It's sort of giving credence to this whole folk hero type of myth that has developed around El Chapo.
Right. But don't you think that most real journalists, if given the opportunity to interview El Chapo on the run, mm-hmm. would have done so?
And I would say probably most journalists, given the opportunity, yes, they would. Now, I want to clarify that. I would say most journalists with an understanding of the situation in Mexico and of the influence of these cartels would not. Most people who I know who live in the Southwest who are journalists, who have covered, say, Texas, Mexico, Arizona, who are professional journalists, would not, because the risk of angering these cartels is too great. It might sound, for example, in theory, if someone were to approach me and say, would you want to go interview El Chapo? If you conduct a great interview with El Chapo, you could potentially win a Pulitzer Prize. It's a, you know, it's a place, you know, it's a type of notoriety and, you know, type mm-hmm. of renown. But is it worth risking your life or your family's life? For me personally, and for many of the Latino journalists I know who have covered the Southwest of Mexico, the answer is no. And I think that's borne out by the fact by so many journalists in Mexico who are living with this violence all around them on a daily basis, they would not do it. And I have been fascinated by the reaction from the press, the different reaction in the press by the U.S. in Mexico. Here, this whole story is sort of seen through the celebrity lens as like a type of undercover caper conducted by Sean Penn, and that fits in with his, you know, rebellious image as a bad boy. In Mexico, there's been much more criticism of it. The government is hugely embarrassed. One major Mexico City paper accused Kate Del Castillo, the actress who was also involved, of functioning as a PR woman for El Chapo. So there's been a lot of negative reaction in Mexico, because obviously there, literally, this all hits close to home.
And yet, if it's true that his interview led to El Chapo's capture, then wouldn't he be lauded in Mexico?
I think if they're saying that his interview had led in part to his capture. I'm not sure if people would say it would be lauded, only because it's been such an embarrassment. It's been an embarrassment, a humiliation, really, twice for the Mexican government. First, that he was able to escape again, And now that that two celebrities were able to find El Chapo, conduct an interview, and this was actually supposed to come out, I believe, Friday, and then they just moved it up because of the news of his capture. So maybe he might win some type of approval in that sense for bringing El Chapo to justice, but I'm not sure. I would not be surprised at all if there were some charges lodged against either of them. I know on the U.S. side, in this interview, Sean Penn says that El Chapo told him the names of various major U.S. corporations that engaged in money laundering for his syndicate, but Sean Penn declined to name the actual names of these major corporations. I think any prosecutor in the U.S., particularly in a border state, who wanted to make a name for himself, would subpoena Sean Penn and demand to know what are these major foreign corporations? What are their names? And on the Mexican side, you know, the Mexican legal system is very different from ours. Prosecutors have far wider discretion than prosecutors in this country. In fact, trials can be conducted and completely finished without the accused seeing any type of evidence. So it would not surprise me at all if the Mexican government brought charges against either of these two actors, just as, if nothing else, as a face-saving gesture. I know that Kate Del Castillo was supposed to shoot a Netflix series in Mexico in 6 months, and I would not be surprised if somehow that ended up not happening, at least not in Mexico, because the Mexican government is very, at least for now, very angry and upset that this took place before they were able to capture El Chapo.
We've been talking about the Rolling Stone interview of El Chapo by Sean Penn with Raul Reyes, attorney and journalist. Raul, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The Supreme Court heard arguments today in a case that could gut the power of public employee unions. The case is called Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association, and at issue is whether the teachers union can force non-members to pay fees that cover collective bargaining carried out on behalf of all teachers. Lead plaintiff Rebecca Friedrichs says forcing teachers to pay fees is a violation of her First Amendment rights.
We have been forced to fund a union that speaks on our behalf, whether we like it or not. And in many of our cases, we don't like it.
Well, labor leaders argue non-union members should not be able to reap the benefits of their bargaining efforts, while others foot the bill. The AFL-CIO's Richard Trumka believes this case is about gutting workers' power.
The case was brought by billionaires and wealthy CEOs like the Koch brothers, who want to rewrite the rules to only benefit them.
Here with me now to discuss the arguments this morning at the Supreme Court is Dahlia Lithwick. She covers the law in the courts for Slate. Hi, Dahlia.
Hey there, Madeline.
So tell us, the Roberts Court has been pretty friendly to corporate interests in the past. Did they exhibit the same tendencies this morning?
They did, and in fairness, I think they teed this up 2 years ago in a case where they almost did what it looks like they're going to do today, which is really, I think, do away with these, quote, agency fees, which are used, as you said, to ask non-union members to pay only the portion of union activity that goes to collective bargaining. So the court kind of gog-whistled this in 2014, and I think it looked like at argument today they're ready to do the deal.
Oh, and is this where Anthony Kennedy would provide the swing vote?
You know, it's not. This is an area of law. First of all, you know, this is a speech case, and Anthony Kennedy is, in fact, extremely speech protective. And right out the gate today, he was very clear. He sounded a lot like Rebecca Friedrichs did in your clip. Mm-hmm. You know, this is speech. This is compelled speech. You're taking this huge swath of people and forcing them to say something they don't agree with. So I don't think anyone thought Kennedy was in play. There was some question about whether Justice Antonin Scalia was in play, only because he sometimes has been quite solicitous of this 40-year-old precedent that says, look, this arrangement is in the best interest of all the employees, it's in the best interest of the unions and the state, but I don't think Scalia evinced any real sensitivity today. The unions or the state of California or the Solicitor General's office, all of whom were arrayed against Rebecca Friedrich.
Now, I understand that Anthony Kennedy said something to the effect of collective bargaining is inherently political if the employer is the federal federal government. And so does that seem to be one of the core arguments in this case as to whether or not this is a political act, bargaining for salary, for tenure, for, let's say, smaller class sizes?
That is, in fact, the heart of the argument that Friedrichs and the other plaintiffs make. They say that in this deal that was struck in 1977, in this Abood case, where it was determined that non-union members could certainly not be forced to pay fees towards overtly political activities that the union undertook, they could be asked, because of this free rider problem, right, they're benefiting from collective bargaining, they can be asked to pay fees toward collective bargaining and other just purely employment activities. And the heart of this case is there's no such distinction, that when you're talking about firefighters or teachers, everything, including collective bargaining, is ideological and partisan and political, and teachers shouldn't be commandeered into that message. Now, the problem with that, of course, is it's not a principled reason to overrule a 40-year-old precedent, which half of the states, all the states that have these agency fee arrangements, would now really, really be forced in a profound way to rethink the way public sector unions work. So the idea that this was wrongly decided in 1977, sorry we all relied on it, oops, that that's going to be the basis for reversing it is problematic, because it was certainly always the case that even in 1977 there was, you know, if all political speech, if all collective bargaining is inherently political, that would have been the case then as well.
So it's not the facts that have changed so much, it's the makeup of the court.
Precisely. The facts are identical. The question really is, and I think Justice Stephen Breyer sort of tried to make this very lofty point that, like, look, people rely on us to be, you know, the purveyors of stability and gravitas and seriousness, and we can't just willy-nilly reverse something because now we don't like it.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, you alluded to this earlier, that nearly half of the states would have to change the way they deal with this. What would this do to the unions?
It's interesting, Madeline. That's one of the issues that arose at argument, because there was no trial on these facts. This case rocketed up from the courts after the 2014 invitation by some of the conservative justices to bring a case of this sort. So there's no record. We don't really know what would happen. And one of the things that made at least some of the more liberal justices nervous is, you're just telling us, Rebecca Friedrichs and your co-plaintiffs, that this is going to be fine because in the right-to-work states, public sector unions work out okay. Because we don't really know, we're speculating, and that's quite worrisome, I think, for some of the court. I think one thing that we do know is that if public sector unions cannot rely on huge numbers of their members to pay in, right, because they will not pay in, presumably, if they are going to get the benefits anyhow, then it's going to require public sector unions to have a much more adversarial relationship with their employers, with the state, and I think that there's a real feeling that this could trigger a time that is before Abood, before we had the agency fee rule, where there were a lot more strikes, a lot more unrest. That was, in fact, the core reason the court accepted in Abood the agency fee rule in the first place, was they said, we've got to figure out some way to create labor peace, because the situation before that was so fractious. And the, you know, as you will recall, the amount of striking and the amount of unrest and, in fact, violence was so alarming.
Dahlia Lithwick covers the law and courts for Slate. Thanks, Dahlia.
Thank you so much.
Well, let's hear from you. Should teachers who oppose their unions be able to opt out of paying any fees? We'd love to hear from you, especially if you are a teacher. What do you think of paying these union fees? Give us your thoughts by calling 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can reach out on Facebook or Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, we may look at people who fall for con artists as suckers, but there's probably a con out there that would get any of us.
You would never in a million years recognize one. If you actually spot someone and say, now that's a con artist, that is a bad con artist.
The psychology behind cons, next on Press Play.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Bernie Madoff, Clark Rockefeller, Frank Abagnale, Charles Ponzi, all con artists able to deceive a lot of people out of a lot of money. Just like this character in the David Mamet movie, House of Games.
You want your 80 grand back? I can't give it back. I split it up. What do you want, revenge?
I gave you my trust.
Of course you gave me your trust. That's what I do for a living. You asked me what I did for a living. This is it.
Well, we look at the people who fall for these cons, the marks, as gullible or weak or stupidly greedy. And we see the con artists as cunning, manipulative psychopaths. Well, the reality is more complicated, as Maria Konnikova discovered in writing her new book, The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time. Konnikova has a PhD in psychology, and she often writes about social psychology for magazines like The New Yorker, The Atlantic, and Wired. And she discovered that there are all sorts of cons, maybe one for everyone, including you. Maria Konnikova, welcome to Press Play.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you pepper your book with tons of anecdotes about cons, lots of stories, and they really are irresistible in a schadenfreude kind of way. I mean, I was reading them thinking, well, I would never fall for that. But, you know, people do. And I wonder if you could talk about one big con artist. His name is Ferdinand Waldo Demara. He was called the Great Imposter. Tell us a bit about his story.
Sure. Well, first of all, that's his actual name. I was so blown away and I loved it. You know, where's Waldo? Right there in his first name. And he really intrigued me because, first of all, he operated over multiple decades and he was unmasked multiple times, and yet he always came back and he did these absolutely insane seeming things. The one that opens the book was the one that really caught my eye, and it was when during the Korean War he impersonated a naval surgeon and did it so successfully that he was appointed as the surgeon on a ship of soldiers going into Korea to fight. And he was the only doctor on board this ship. So the Navy actually took a guy who didn't even finish high school and entrusted the lives of hundreds of men into his hands.
Wow.
But that's not the end of the story. He actually performed surgery. So when he was in the high seas, they came across a group of Korean soldiers who'd been in an ambush and they had been quite injured. And he actually performed surgery on them. He had a medical textbook on board and he somehow managed to pull this off.
Wow. And as one says, that's not all. There's more, because Robert Crichton wrote his biography and Demara conned him into, he wanted to deliver his pregnant wife's baby and Robert Crichton agreed.
Yep, that's absolutely right. So Demara managed to con Crichton not just once, but multiple times over multiple years. So he wanted to deliver his baby. Crichton actually put this proposition in front of his wife because he decided that, well, Demara's a pretty good surgeon. You know, he saved all those people in Korea. His wife obviously was aghast, so that never happened. Then he proceeded to steal Crichton's identity and to use it as one of his covers. Even after that, Crichton forgave him and gave him a good recommendation for future jobs. Demara took him to court, not once, but twice, suing him for money he said he'd never gotten for the book and then the subsequent movie, which was a patently false lawsuit. Crichton proceeded to pay for his education, to buy him a new car, to keep sending him letters of recommendation and telling people that he was going to be reformed. That's how much this guy got to him.
Wow.
He really believed in him up until the end.
So what does that tell you about the psychology of the con artist?
I think that tells you just how remarkably persuasive they are. You would never in a million years recognize one. If you actually spot someone and say, now that's a con artist, that is a bad con artist. The best con artists are charismatic people who really make you feel wonderful, make you feel like they care about you, build emotional rapport with you. They're people you consider friends. And ultimately, if I were to tell you, hey, this person is taking you for a ride, you are getting conned, you might not believe me. You might yell at me and tell me what an awful judge of character I am. And you'll persist in believing that this con artist is actually genuine.
Amazing. So are they psychopaths?
Some of them, yes, absolutely. Not all of them. I talk in the book about the so-called dark triad of traits, which is psychopathy, narcissism, which is being very enamored of yourself, but also having the sense of entitlement that you really have things coming to you and you don't have to work as hard for them as anyone else because you deserve them, and Machiavellianism, or having the persuasive abilities to get people to do what you want, like Machiavelli's Prince. And in a way, you have to have something of that dark triad, because you're really putting people's lives on the line, in the case of someone like Damara, quite literally, in the case of someone like Bernie Madoff, a little bit more figuratively, but still, you know, these are people's life savings. And if you care about your victims, you can't do that.
Yeah.
So you have to have some degree of callousness. It doesn't always have to be psychopathy, but there does have to be something of that in there. And you have to be very, very good at persuasive abilities, at being able to persuade people to do what you want them to do. So that's where Machiavellianism comes in. And not everyone will turn to being a con artist, because people don't always feel like they're entitled to that. So that's why I think narcissism is actually quite important.
And are humans innately trusting?
Absolutely. Evolutionarily, it's much more adaptive to trust people than to think that they're deceiving us. And that happens from the earliest stages. When you're an infant and when you're a young child, you obviously have to trust that the big people around you are going to protect you. And after that, it's what makes society function, that we trust one another, that we actually think the best of other people. And there have been some really interesting studies that show that higher levels of generalized trust correlate with all sorts of good things like happiness, health, intelligence, that countries with higher levels of trust end up doing better economically because it really facilitates social interaction. Whereas if we went around distrusting anyone, I think society would not be a very pleasant place to be in.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Maria Konnikova. She's written a new book called The Confidence Game. Can you give us some examples of the tricks that they use?
Sure. One of the things that they often will use is to mirror yourself back at you. So they're not only very good at reading people, but they realize that one of the things that makes you like someone, that makes you trust someone, is feeling a sense of affinity. And that sense of affinity often comes from thinking that you're like them, that you're similar to them, or that they're familiar to you. And so often they'll try to glean background details, for instance, where you're from. So they could find out that I'm from the Boston suburbs. And they'll say, oh, really? You're from Acton? I grew up in Concord. So they pick a town right near mine, but not exactly mine. And then right away we have a point in common and we start talking about this. Then they might start talking about the Red Sox and the Red Sox season. And all of a sudden I feel like, hey, you know, this is probably a pretty nice person. And I start trusting them. I start letting down my guard because this is someone who is similar to me. Even though they're probably not from the Boston area, they don't care about the Red Sox, they're just very good at picking up on those details and making me feel like I'm talking with someone I could actually be friends with. So that's one technique. Another that's quite related is being a familiar face. There's a psychological phenomenon known as the mirror exposure effect, which means that merely being exposed to something makes us like it more. So a lot of times con artists will insinuate themselves into communities so that they become a familiar face and you start trusting them because you just see them and so you like them, and liking someone breeds a feeling of trust. So those are two very, very easy things that they can do before they've even really said anything or tried to sell you on anything. It's just their ability to be in the right place and say the right thing.
And then they have their techniques once they've lured you in, what you call in your chapter, the rope. That one was really interesting, one example you gave of a wine dealer or a wine merchant. He had some very precious bottles of wine, and he refused to sell them to,
yes,
to this guy over and over again, which only made,
yep,
of course, the wine more desirable. Tell us about that story.
Yeah, so you're talking about Rudy Kernyawan, who was one of the expert wine fraudsters of our time. He had an exquisite palate, and he was able to manufacture all of these bottles of wine so that people really thought that they were the real deal. And he would have these dinners, he would throw these lavish parties where he'd have real bottles of wine, and then he would have his fakes. And he said that he had discovered this hidden cellar in France, which was actually plausible in the sense that new wine is being discovered, new cellars are coming to light. But the way he operated was on this principle of scarcity. He made it seem like an incredibly exclusive club, that he had these wines, yes, but he didn't have very many of them, and they were just for the most exclusive palates. He wouldn't just give it to any collector. You really had to make it into his club. And so this very famous wine collector in Northern California, Wilf Jaeger, really wanted some of these wines, and he'd known Rudy from the very beginning, and he kept approaching him and approaching him and approaching him, and Rudy kept saying no. And finally, he sent him a few cases of wine. Wilf, to his credit, was a very good taster, opened one of the bottles, thought it tasted off, sent them all back. Probably one of the reasons he was willing to speak to me about this, because he was not actually taken in by the con.
Right. And then he took them back, right?
He did.
The con man.
He took them back right away. And the funny thing is, though, even though Wilf Jaeger thought that they tasted off, he didn't think that they were fake. He just thought they were poorly stored. He thought something else was wrong with it. He trusted Rudy. He didn't for a second suspect him of fraud.
But do most con artists get away with it because the marks are too embarrassed that they have
yes.
been scammed?
Yes. The vast, vast majority of cons go unreported for two reasons. One is reputation. People don't want to acknowledge that they've been scammed. They don't want other people to see them as suckers. And because, by the way, no matter how smart they are, people will see them as suckers. Lots of very intelligent people invested with Bernie Madoff, but people look at them and say, how could you invest with Bernie Madoff? Are you insane? So that really does hurt your reputation. But the other reason is that sometimes they don't even realize, they don't acknowledge to themselves that they've been conned. It's a very powerful ego protection mechanism where you say, you know what? Bad luck. It was just the luck of the draw, and I ended up getting the short end of the deal, and that's the way it happens sometimes.
Have you ever gotten conned?
Very good question, and the answer is I really don't know, because I think some of the best cons, you'll never know that it was a con. I don't invest in the markets, so I know that I have never been the victim of a Ponzi scheme. I am sure that I've given some money to people who didn't really need it and who lied to me about the reasons why they were asking for money. So on that level, I'm sure that I've been conned. In a big way, I'm sure that I will be at some point, especially after this book comes out. I think I'll become the perfect target. People will try to say, oh, she wrote a book about this. She probably thinks she's so smart. So I'm betting that I'm going to get really conned in the next few years.
Really? Even you? And you're so hyper aware of it?
Absolutely. Well, that's the beauty of it. And that's why it's so incredibly pervasive and so powerful, that the good con artist will be able to hook you no matter what, even if you are the person who studies this. It's like the story of a doctor who was one of the leading experts in psychopathy, and he'd been studying this his whole life. And it ended up late in his career that one of his lab assistants, one of his postdocs, was actually a psychopath who'd been lying and abusing some of the research subjects, and he had no idea. He missed all the signs.
Wow.
So I think it would be something like that.
Well, maybe you'll write about it when it happens.
Maybe I will.
Or maybe you'll be too
embarrassed. Good follow-up.
Maria Konnikova is the author of the new book, The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, is it a con? The Golden Globes? I don't know. We'll talk about it. Plus, a new prestige drama in our regular TV segment. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. As is the case most years, the viewers were the real winners at last night's Golden Globes. The Oscars' drunk little brother was full of surprise wins, boozy celebs, and of course, Ricky Gervais.
Oh, this show is way too long, isn't it?
It's way too... This could be half an hour. This one was in the writer's strike when they just read the winners and just... Okay, let's get through it.
It was the fourth time Gervais has hosted the Globes. Well, back to the surprise wins. That's where we want to start with Alan Sepinwall, TV critic for HitFix. Hi, Alan.
Hey, Madeline. How are you?
I'm great. Lady Gaga?
It's the Golden Globes. Why are you questioning anything that the Hollywood Foreign Press Association does?
I know. We have to throw logic just out the window, right?
No, there's this weird group. Nobody even knows who they are. They just, through a fluke of timing, that their awards comes at the exact right midpoint of Oscar season. Everyone is now just taking them seriously, and the TV awards get latched onto that, and they do lots of crazy stuff.
One crazy thing that they did was to award Gael Garcia Bernal Best Actor in a Comedy, a show called Mozart in the Jungle, which also won some other major awards, beating out Transparent and Veep. And I'm not sure a lot of people watch that show, Mozart in the Jungle.
It's a perfectly pleasant little comedy. It is far, 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 far from the best comedy on TV, but the Globes want to seem cool, and so they're like, we're going to pick a streaming show, and in this case, we're going to not pick Transparent, which is the easy streaming show to do. We're going to go with one no one's ever heard of, so we seem cutting edge, but also, in this case, one with an international leading man, which they also often like.
Well, they do seem a lot more diverse than the film side of things, right? I mean, there's Gael Garcia Bernal, Oscar Isaac, Taraji P. Henson, all won last night. Meanwhile, on the film side, it seemed a lot, you know, more traditional.
Their winners are always interesting. They're often goofy, but, like, they're often more interesting than, like, what the Emmys do, just because, again, they're such weirdos and they're not as hidebound as the TV Academy. And so they'll pick a Mr. Robot. I doubt Mr. Robot will ever win an actual Emmy, but that's a really good show.
Okay, let's talk about a show that is premiering, I believe, next weekend, Billions on Showtime. The first episode airs on Sunday, and the show stars Paul Giamatti and Damian Lewis.
When did it become a crime to succeed in this country? Everyone has access to the information. We just know how to analyze it better.
We spotted a suspect trading pattern.
You must get pings like that every day.
All three firms have links to Bobby Axelrod.
Okay, who is Bobby Axelrod?
Bobby Axelrod is the Damian Lewis character. He heads a successful hedge fund. He's sort of a rags-to-riches story. Giamatti is the U.S. Attorney of the Southern District of New York, who is out to get Bobby Axelrod in part because his wife works for him, and it's very complicated and very nasty.
Is it good? Do you like it?
I have mixed feelings about it. It's created by the guys who wrote Rounders, plus Andrew Ross Sorkin, who obviously knows Wall Street in and out. And there's some really good performers in there, but it spends a lot of the time trying to explain exactly why Paul Giamatti has to take down this Wall Street guy of all Wall Street guys, and it never really gets there. So despite the fact that it looks good and it's got good actors, it moves in fits and starts.
Hmm. Let's end with you giving us your recommendation for best new show of 2016 so far.
Let's see. At Press Tour, we got a lot of different screeners of things. I liked the pilot for HBO's Vinyl, but I think the thing I liked the most of what I've seen is Love, which is a comedy coming up on Netflix, I think, in February, from Judd Apatow. It stars Gillian Jacobs from Community and Paul Rust, who's one of the stars of the show as well. And it's sort of this unconventional romantic comedy about two people who meet in L.A. And it ebbs and flows and takes advantage of the fact that it has 10 episodes. And, you know, I'm a TV critic. There's too much TV on right now. I get too many screeners. And I watched all 10 episodes of this in about a day.
Oh, okay. Maybe future Golden Globe winner. Who knows?
It's streaming. They love streaming.
Alan Sepinwall, TV critic for the entertainment news website HitFix. Thanks, Alan.
Thanks, Madeline.
And that'll do it for us today. Warren Olney and To The Point up next at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great afternoon. I'll see you tomorrow.